Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy. Recording is 12:59 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is September 20th. I thought that today we would kick off with the Fed Funds effective rate because it gave some volatility earlier on in the week. It got up to 2.3% despite the fact that the Federal Reserve cut interest rates down to 1.75% to 2%. So it was well outside of the range that the Fed was attempting to hold on to. I've been reading these reports from the STIR desk, the short-term interest rate desk at Credit Suisse. I've posted another one of those in here today. They're about the best explainer of exactly what's going on in the short-term interest rate market, and most specifically the repo market, that I've been able to find. I'm posting another one in here today, and I strongly suggest anyone who's interested in the minutiae of what's going on that one should take the time to read it. It's incredibly dense stuff, and I wouldn't say easy to comprehend, but there are a couple of very clear takeaways. The first is that the Federal Reserve has a choice. They can either control the lower bound of the interest rate, so they're effectively doing that, but they have difficulty controlling the upper bound. When they set a rate, it's between, for example, currently 1.75 to 2%. Earlier this week, the overnight repo rate got up to 8%. So that's rather extreme. It was indicative of an extreme lack of liquidity. The Federal Reserve has been reducing the size of their balance sheet. So what we can really start to think about from a very top-down perspective is that the Federal Reserve has been reducing the size of its balance sheet, and that has been withdrawing the supply of dollars. There has been an extraordinary number of bonds from Europe and Japan that have got negative yields. Well, that creates demand for US dollar denominated assets because they have got those positive yields. That has created a collateral surfeit, that there is more demand out there than there is available credit or available liquidity. That has pushed up the interest rates. So one answer to that would be to simply create more dollars. That is exactly what's going on in here this week. We can see, for example, that the size of the Fed's balance sheet at the end of August was $3.75 trillion. It's gone up $300 billion, and it's up to $3.8 now. Well, that's a pretty significant move. More than anything else, it very clearly states that quite regardless of the outlook for another bout of quantitative easing, the Fed's balance sheet is going to start expanding again. If we're going to further distill this big question about the repo market and the complication of it all, it really comes down to a very simple fact that it's difficult to have a strong currency when you are also expanding the supply of it. If the Federal Reserve is going to continue to try and supply the market with the liquidity that it requires in order to ensure there is a clear functioning of the repo market and that rates are kept within the band that they are trying to address, they are either going to have to create a permanent repo facility, and that is going to create a rather difficult environment for them, because that would then allow the infinite expansion of the Fed's balance sheet to be used by the private sector, and that's obviously not something they want to do. On the other hand, what they could do is just cut interest rates to make the dollar less attractive. One way or the other, they're going to have to involve an additional supply of liquidity. When we then think about just looking at very simple measures of money, like M1, well, that has continued to increase. When we look at M2, then that's also been trending higher. It's also, I think, rather important to look at the velocity of money when we think about these things, because it has been trending down for an awfully long time. The fact that the velocity of money peaked ahead of the peak in the technology boom in the late 1990s and has been trending down since has been one of the primary reasons why people have been very much attached to the deflation and to the technology led deflationary forces that have shaped the economy over the course of the last 25 years. What we can see, though, is that the pace of the decline in the velocity of money has been arrested over the course of the last 2 years. But against that background, the supply of money has continued to advance. Now, that should be inflationary. We haven't had a lot of inflation, that at least of the kind that central banks monitor. But the cost of living increases have been occurring, not least because of wage demand growth and also because of services, most particularly in the healthcare and education sectors. If the Federal Reserve now is going to start increasing the supply of dollars, then that raises some important questions about one, the outlook for the economy, where we are moving back towards a more stimulative environment. That is going to increase the potential for a bubble to form. That's perhaps one of the most important factors. When we look at what's going on in terms of the S&P 500, then the market was in negative territory in here today. Having been above the 3,000 level for much of the day, it closed on the lower side of the day's range, but the activity around this 3,000 level has been really quite inert over the course of the last 10 days. And as long as it is continuing to bounce from the region of the trend mean, I think we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. One of the reasons why the stock market was a little bit softer in here today is that President Trump was clearly stating that he's not going to settle for a partial agreement in terms of trade. And that pretty much punctured some of the enthusiasm around the potential for the trade war to ebb. But on the other hand, that does increase the potential that the Federal Reserve will continue to flood the market with additional dollars. They've been contracting the supply of dollars over the course of the last while, and that has helped to push the value of the dollar higher. I don't think that the dollar index is the best arbiter of exactly what the dollar is doing. It gives entirely too much weight to the euro, and the euro has been particularly weak because of the challenges that the European economy faces as a result of the trade war and the slowdown in China. Nevertheless, the pace of the advance has been reasonably moderate, and having been in negative territory earlier on in the day, it has continued to hold here above this 98 level. The Bloomberg Dollar Index doesn't have as big a weighting in the euro, and that has not been as impressive on the upside, but it is at least bouncing from above the trend mean in here. This continues to suggest that there is a bid underway for the dollar, despite the fact that it is increasingly likely that the Federal Reserve is going to be increasing the supply of them. The most important point right now is that the Federal Reserve this week has expressed some reticence to continue to cut interest rates. That does mean that as long as they demur from cutting interest rates, then they are pretty much tied to continually supporting the repo market. And that is going to push up the value or the size of their balance sheet and the quantity of dollars in circulation. So that is likely to be an inhibiting factor in terms of the continued advance in the dollar. But until that arbitrage between the negative yields in Europe and Japan relative to the positive yields on US Treasuries is closed, then that is likely to continue to represent a net positive for the dollar. Well, what that I think generally does suggest is that we are going to have a range form on the dollar. One of the, I think, the most appropriate ways of looking at the dollar is on the broad index. And it was breaking higher at the end of August. It's now, it should have been updated by the close in here today. And that hasn't quite happened just yet. But it was at a new all-time high at the end of August. And there is potential for some consolidation. But so far that hasn't happened. When we look at the other important trading partners, US, the real value index for the other important trading partners of the US, then this is also pushing on to new high ground. So that's an additional important consideration that the US dollar is now appreciating more versus emerging market currencies. Now, there is a good reason for that. It's because its emerging market currencies have tended to be those or economies where there have been companies issuing debt in US dollars. That's putting downward pressure on their currencies. There is a shortage of dollars. The shortage of dollars has been exacerbated by the contracting of the Fed's balance sheet. At least that portion of the trade should start to get better as they increase the size of their balance sheet, but the cost of that money is probably going to become more expensive as long as the Federal Reserve is not cutting interest rates. And there is, I think this is the kind of indecision that we see at in ranging phases for markets. When we look at the S&P 500 over the course of the last decade and more, it has been in a very clear bullish environment, and it has bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average on successive occasions. It's right in the region of its peak right now, and so far, this has continued to look like a reasonably similar sized reaction, with support being found in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. I would consider the 1,000-day average as being the secular trend mean, whereas the 200-day moving average is probably more useful from a medium-term trader's perspective. And even here, we're seeing that there was a clear upside weekly key reversal from the region of the trend mean back in June, and since then we've continued to have an upward bias. This continues to look like a bullish consolidation. I think the fact that 10-year treasury yields are now starting to rise once more, that I think is an important consideration. We had a meaningful pullback over the course of the last few sessions. Now the bigger question is, what is the Federal Reserve going to do both with the supply of additional dollars, with the outlook for the interest rate environment? If we wanted to make a clear bullish argument for the Treasuries, it would be that this arbitrage opportunity that is creating the mismatch in terms of availability and demand in the repo market will have to be closed, which means that the Federal Reserve will have to lower interest rates. Well, if that's the case, then that will put downward pressure on those yields. Having had this rather impressive rebound, now the very clear evidence in order to demonstrate that we're back in a bond supply dominated environment will be if the percent and a half level holds, and subsequently that we see a move in the yield back above the 2% level. If yields continue to decline, then investors are probably going to conclude that there is a deflationary outcome coming. That need not necessarily be the case. It may simply be that we have a distorting effect because of the massive quantity of bonds that still have negative yields. And that level now is at 14.5 trillion. It has paused over the course of the last 3 weeks, but it bounced in here this week. It's back above the $14 trillion level. That continues to represent a pressuring environment for Europe and Japan. Europe and Japan are more influenced by what's going on in China than anywhere else. They are more dependent on exports to China than the USA is. When we look at what's going on in terms of the currency, then the Chinese renminbi is still trading above the 7, or the dollar is still trading above 7 versus the renminbi, and I think it is really rather unlikely that we're going to see it trading stronger than 7 anytime soon. Then when we think about the banking sector, well, there has been a clear downward bias to trading since April of this year. It was in positive territory in here today, but these are all state-owned banks. So they are probably going to be the first to gain some assistance from the central government. The bigger picture is that there is plenty of evidence of a slowdown in demand in the broader economy. There is a slowdown, particularly in the Tier 3 cities, having had a very clear upward bias. There is the additional point that China has been running extraordinarily large deficits. And when we think about that, they're running a deficit right now of 4% of GDP, and it's increasing. So that has been trending. Basically, all we can say for sure is that what China is doing right now is they are running a massive fiscal stimulus. They have very clearly demonstrated that they do not want to step on the gas in terms of the quantitative easing metrics over the course of the last year. They've been clearly saying that that is not something that they're willing to do any longer because they're worried about a property bubble. So they've been instead trying to engage in fiscal stimulus in much the same way that the USA is doing. And that is helping to support the domestic economy, but it's coming at a very significant price. And that is also eating into the ability of the government to continue to do so. That they have tried to change how taxes are collected. There are a significant number of people who don't pay any tax at all. The much bigger point is that there are 50 million homes that there is nobody living in. And that is, I think, a clear example of just how egregious the malinvestment has been. I think one of the clearest ways to monitor exactly what is going on in terms of the Chinese industrial sector is copper. And not least because it plays such an important role in infrastructure development, and copper has been pulling back really quite dynamically from the region of the trend mean in here. When we think about iron ore, then that had been right back in the region of its trend mean, and it is going to have to hold that level if we're to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. When we look at the outlook for the mining sector, we would normally assume that in the latter stages of a bull market, mining shares should be doing better. In fact, as one of the primary cyclical sectors, they often peak well after the wider market. But there is the real potential that if China is in fact the epicenter of global risk right now, then we should not expect the mining sector to experience the kind of pop on the upside that would normally be associated with late stage moves. In fact, it's the relative weakness of commodities is more a sign of the weakness of the Chinese economy than probably any other factor. And that is potentially also what the contraction in yields and the tightness in the dollar funding markets is telling us, that there is extraordinary demand for dollars. There is a clear migration of Chinese investors out of China. They're doing anything they can possibly come up with to exit or to try and get their money out of China. I am limited by non-disclosure agreements to talk specifically about what I know, but I can guarantee you that from the meetings I've had over the course of the last month, that I see more evidence of Chinese investors trying to get their money out of the country than I've ever seen before. And that's normal. When you try to impose capital controls, that only increases anxiety. That tells people that the window is closing quickly, and that if they don't get their money out fast, then they really do need to get some acceleration going in terms of their planning. Well, there's a really quite good reason why gold is doing better, and it is firming from the $1,500 area in here today. But what I find most interesting is the fact that against the renminbi, it is clearly breaking higher. And there is really quite clear potential that it is going to do substantially better from here. When we look at Chinese tourist figures that are going to Hong Kong, and they are buying fewer of the luxury goods, but anecdotal evidence suggests that they are clearing out the gold shops. What that is quite clearly suggesting is that there is really quite clear potential for some of Chinese are the Hong Kong based gold sellers to start to do better. And they really are quite depressed now, and not least because of the pressure that is coming to bear on Hong Kong. I find one of the interesting points about what's going on in Hong Kong is really worth considering. When we go back and think about what was it that really lit the spark in the Arab Spring, it was the rising price of food in Tunisia. And higher commodity prices have been one of the clearest catalysts for social unrest in a substantially in a lot of less developed markets. What we're starting to see now with the rise of populism, and then also the social unrest that we're getting in Hong Kong, is that it is a threat to living standards generally that is now stoking agitation in more developed markets. In Hong Kong in particular, it is the price of housing. One of the big differences between Hong Kong and Singapore is that Singapore has a long history of providing social housing. So despite the fact there has been a massive move in terms of the price of private housing in Singapore, it is still possible for regular Singaporean people to get social housing and keep that cost under control. Whereas Hong Kong does simply not have that same social housing tradition. Well, with the flood of mainland money and people into Hong Kong as an enclave, then that has pushed up the price of property to absolutely extraordinary levels, where it is now at a higher base rate than you see in London or New York. And that is pricing out hundreds of thousands of people from ever getting on the property ladder, but it's also raising rents and making it very difficult for people to simply survive. That is a clear threat to their way of life, and it is obvious that that is one of the real catalysts behind this agitation. Well, there are plans to build very significant numbers of new social housing units in up towards the Chinese border with the Shenzhen, but they won't be built overnight. And what that suggests is that very clear measures are going to have to be spelled out to try and alleviate the social pressures. There is the real potential that it is going to create a policy mistake. There is a massive number of stories circulating, particularly on social media, about how protesters have been abused, how there are people masquerading as Hong Kong police, how the Hong Kong police have hired thugs to beat up protesters and to agitate. Well, there are, on the other hand, there are not quite as many stories about how local people don't support the protesters. But the reality is that when you have 1 million or even 2 million people protesting in a city of 8 million people, then it's hard to argue that there isn't a popular movement going on. And when we think about the Hang Seng, well, it is still under pressure. It has got this sequence of lower rally highs over this year. What we need to see in Hong Kong and China is some engagement with the protest movement to address the underlying causes. It's not only about the extradition, or the well, it's the non-judicial extradition which issue that set off this entire protest movement. That was the catalyst. It was the threat to the way of life, but it was really the straw that broke the camel's back. That there is really a clear threat to the living standards of people. That has manifested itself in a popular movement in Hong Kong. It has manifested itself in the election of populist leaders right across Europe and in North America. Well, it's also leading to populist movements gaining sway in places like India and Brazil. In fact, it was India had the first populist movement success story in Narendra Modi, and that was at least 6 years ago. This is not going to simply disappear. What I found interesting is that there were articles in here this week talking about the fact that it is normal for populist movements to appear after a credit crisis, and then they compare it to the 1930s, where there was a clear rise in populism after the crash in 1929. They then conclude that they disappeared in the 1940s. They seem to completely brush over the intervening period where there was a world war, and that led to the vanquishing of the populist movement in Germany. Then, therefore, we have to at least lend some credence to the view that the trade war between China and the USA is not a short-term consideration. And then we have to consider what is likely to occur in the run-up to the next US presidential cycle. Both sides of the House are expressing an increasingly ambivalent attitude towards China. Therefore, betting or waiting out President Trump in the hope that he will be replaced by a more favorable administration is, I think, going to prove a vain strategy from China's perspective. I think it is quite likely that it is going to be Elizabeth Warren is going to be the Democratic candidate for the simple reason that she's within striking distance of Biden in Iowa at present. If Bernie Sanders leaves the race, then the progressive element that have been supporting him are naturally going to migrate to Elizabeth Warren, and that will take her to a stronger position than Joe Biden in the polls. And that is, provided there is not a significant misstep, then she is likely to become the adversary of President Trump in the election. Well, considering the progressive element of the party that she represents and the clearly ambivalent tone she has towards the corporate sector generally, where she is championing redistribution versus freedom of opportunity, then that is a very clear risk to stock markets generally. Now, when we think about what's going on in terms of the market today, then we have got confirmation that we're in the latter stages of this advance. The banking sector remains reasonably firm. High yield spreads are contained and they're back at around 380 basis points. If they were surging through 5%, we would be having a different conversation, but they are still relatively well contained. Delinquency rates are still reasonably well contained, but auto rates are trending, or auto delinquency rates are trending higher. One of the reasons why mortgage delinquency rates have not been trending higher is because of mortgage standards have been so much tighter in the aftermath of the credit crisis. It's also because people didn't have the money to speculate, whereas people have been putting more money into their cars. And the evolution of the $80,000 SUV is something that is representative of this over leverage that we have in the auto loan sector. The continued trending feature behind this does suggest that it's going to be one of the areas where there is going to be some pressure coming to build in the next recession. Then, when we look at SLM Corp, well, they are issuing a significant number of the federal education loans. And this price series has been trending lower since 2017. There is an extraordinary quantity of student debt that is outstanding, and that has grown very substantially over the course of the last decade. That's also likely to be one of the factors that has an effect on sentiment, and not least the ability of people to manage their finances during a recessionary environment. But when we look at initial jobless claims having been spiked on the upside right at the beginning of the year, it has come all the way back down to test its lows. Now, this is generally speaking a volatile price series, so it needs to not only pop on the upside, but needs to sustain that move, and hasn't really done that at any point in this expansion. What we did see back in 2007 was that it broke out and then it started finding support in the region of the trend mean, and then it was really clearly trending higher in early 2008. We're just not seeing that now. So, despite the fact that we've had an inverted yield curve and it is currently sitting around 3 basis points, it is worth considering that what we see with an inverted yield curve is a very long lead time to the next recession. It can be anything from 6 to 18 months forward. The first inversion was at the end of 2005, and we had the crash in 2008. But the market had put in a type 2 top and loss of momentum and massive reaction against the prevailing trend from 2006 through 2007. What that suggests is that we could see this market break higher. In the last two inversions, what happened over the course of the subsequent 12 months was we saw significant moves on the upside. And then we had top formation development. For example, we know that the market had eventually become inverted at the end of 2005 and rallied by an additional 30% before the peak in 2007. It also became inverted in 1998 and then just about rallied an additional 50% before eventually peaking. Well, despite the fact that the market is up on a 350% since 2009, there is the potential that following the inversion of the yield curve, that this is when we start to get bubbly activity. There is the real potential that if the Federal Reserve stops if they do not cut interest rates and simply increase the supply of dollars, then that's going to ease the dollar funding for emerging markets. It will help to reinvigorate global growth, and therefore that should help to stoke demand globally and help on a reflation trade. On the other hand, if they cut interest rates, then that is something that will help to devalue the dollar, but it will also flood the market with liquidity and then lead to a bubbly environment. So there is the potential here that the most likely scenario is we do get the markets breaking on the upside. Now, there is the counter argument, and it is that the continued compression in yields globally is pricing in a deflationary environment, that the underperformance of copper in particular is a signal that the real epicenter of risk today is China, and that is not being factored into what's happening on Wall Street today. If that's the case, if China is on the cusp of significantly slower growth, and arguably it already has negative real growth because inflationary pressures are starting to pick up, that when we think about pork prices, the price in the USA might be still quite soft, but the price of wholesale pork per kilogram in China has gone from a low back in 2018 of about 16, or really about 14, and it's currently around 36. This has been a very meaningful change. It suggests, and it is worth reminding ourselves, that pork is the staple protein for the majority of Chinese dishes. Then soybeans are also one of the staples in terms of protein consumption. I'm very skeptical of the news that came out a couple of weeks ago that China has been able to get control of its armyworm infestation through the use of drones. We've had a lot of news about drones over the course of the last week. Most of the drones I've seen in China are nothing more than remote-controlled helicopters that have been retooled. Obviously, Iran's military drones that were able to attack the major oil refinery in Saudi Arabia are much more sophisticated. We also saw in here this week that Google is starting to team up with, I think it was Walgreens, at looking at getting drones to deliver pharmaceuticals or to fulfill prescriptions and deliver them to customers. So obviously, when we talk about drones, there are a number of different kinds, and it is really more about the quality of the batteries, the speed of recharging, and the artificial intelligence that goes into plotting the flight paths that are the more of the investment trends rather than the hardware. The hardware itself is highly dependent on the batteries, and that suggests that it is innovation in batteries is the real enabling technology that could help to power this innovation. But the bigger picture is that China has a history of fudging its statistics, and they have not mentioned that the army worm can move, or the moth itself can move 100 kilometers a day, that they are prolific consumers of agricultural products. And the news report to say that it was done and dusted and that this is a non-story just does not have credibility, particularly in view of the fact that prices for agricultural commodities keep moving higher. It's looking increasingly likely that China does have an inflationary problem. And against that background, it has a slowing economy. So stagflation in China is a real potential outcome. And they are continuing to run these extraordinarily large fiscal deficits. That represents the clear risk here, that China is on the cusp of a significant slowdown. If people are thinking about a Cold War evolving between the USA and China, the vast majority of commentary that I've seen is that we're moving into a multipolar world where America trades with the Americas and Europe trades with Europe and China trades with Asia. But that's assuming that China's economy does not contract. The way the last Cold War ended was with the economic collapse of the USSR. And that could quite easily be the end outlook for what we can anticipate from the or the that's the objective of the trade war. Now, if that is in fact the case, then China is by far the epicenter of risk. Everybody is worrying about negative yields and about the supply of dollars and about the threat of deflation and the quantity of debt that's outstanding. But the catalyst for a change that could really affect the global economy would be a collapse in China. And I do believe that that is the factor that needs closest attention, particularly because it isn't being priced into markets at all. Now, when we continue to look at what's going on in terms of the stock market, then I do think that it is likely we're going to get into the bubbly phase. So it could be a problem in China, it could be an escalation of the trade war, or it could be slowing activity as a result of a slowdown in China that could be the catalyst for a problem later. And that is part of the reason why gold remains on a recovery trajectory. And when we think about the longer term consideration, that it has been rallying in a really quite impressive manner now for the last couple of months, but that's only a couple of months on the upside following a 6-year range. The similarities that we have following the big move on the upside in the late 1990s are that we had the big pop on the upside, and it was approximately 2.5 years later that we had a move again on the upside, and that breakout was about 18%. We had the big pop on the upside in 2016. The market went sideways for 2.5 years, and then we had a move of about 15%. Well, last time it came all the way back down and tested the upper side of the range. Well, history rhymes, it doesn't repeat itself, but it does suggest that we are in for a somewhat lengthier consolidation. And that is assuming that we're not going to see higher levels first. So far, this range has been relatively similar sized to what we had back in June and July, and today's strength is notable. What we're definitely seeing is that there is continued demand for gold, and the reason for that is a hedge against calamity, against the potential that we are moving into a more risky environment, that there is clear bubble risk evolving, and that China's devaluation of its currency and the slowdown in domestic growth is a very meaningful event. And if that's the case, then there is potential for gold to do substantially better from here. The fact that it is rallying today against a background where bonds are also rallying suggests that there is scope for additional upside here as long as bond yields are compressing. When we start to think then about the longer term outlook, the debt question is going to become front and center. On a social basis, the question of inequality is something that everyone is going to have to start to contend with. This very big argument about the on one hand, it is the reasonable argument that everybody should have equal opportunity to improve their position in life through education and hard work. On the other, it is that the elites control the system, that the injustices have gone on for too long, and that it is time for a leveling of the system so that everybody can start again at an equal footing. Well, the problem with the difference in opinion is that the progressive element are much more agitated. They are expressing their anger and their commitment to their ideals, and they have the potential to sway the electorate in just simply on the basis that they're promising more, and that people tend to vote with their self-interest. But all of it is a wider, I think, revolution against the status quo, that people have become simply disillusioned with the decision to promote globalization in deference to a commitment to improving the living standards of a substantial portion of the domestic population for OECD countries. And this isn't something that is simply going to go away. So the fact that there is also the potential for a generational divide, where it is the older generations have benefited most acutely from lower interest rates and rising asset prices, and most particularly property prices over the course of the last 40 years. And it is the younger generations are coming in, trying to buy property, trying to pay off debts with wages that are stagnant, and are seeing a constriction in not only their living standards, but also in their ability to improve their living standards. That's a question that isn't easily answered, and it is something that is going to get exercised at the ballot box, not just in this election cycle, but in all subsequent election cycles, because the younger people will increasingly outnumber the older people the further along this cycle goes. The pace of technological innovation is potentially both an acceleration factor, but also an inhibiting factor. The potential for deflationary forces to arise as a result of the march of technology is certainly something that could aid the deflationary argument, but it could also exacerbate this debate about how do people earn a wage that they feel can allow them to achieve the living standards that they feel are fair. Inflation is probably the answer. And the quantity of debt that is outstanding, the very clear potential that that debt is going to continue to expand and most particularly as yields continue to compress. This suggests that there is a bubble in bonds. This move into negative territory, it virtually ensures that we're going to have a problem later. Somebody absolutely has to bear the drawdown risk of buying bonds above par. And that's most particularly going to be central banks. They're the primary buyers of bonds with negative yields. How do they make up for the losses they're going to take? Well, the easy answer is they're going to print money. So that does represent a clear risk of inflation. It represents the clearest argument for a currency war, a competitive devaluation. And that's one of the biggest arguments for why we should have a continued move in gold. That the answer to a lot of the world's problems is simply print currency. And against a background where gold has limited supply, or reasonably limited supply, then that does represent a bullish phenomenon. The other point is that Bitcoin has been very inert around the 10,000 point level. It has much less supply. In fact, most of the Bitcoin that have been mined have been lost. And then we have to consider that the reward for mining Bitcoin is going to halve in May of next year. That suggests that the next significant leg on the upside is likely, or the next significant leg out of this range is going to be on the upside. And I think the optionality that we have here is when it breaks, it's going to break in a dynamic manner. Whether that is going to be up or down, it is certainly a market that is worth monitoring at this stage. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.